how do you find bravery when you have a cancer diagnosis?
Empathy is the antidote to fear. So usually I get over my fear by sharing it in some way with somebody who can sit with it for a minute and help me dissipate it.
How do we deal with our own emotional challenges?
Fear sells and fear is profitable, so we get triggered over and over again. So part of owning your shit is realizing when you get triggered and talking yourself down, or learning how to reject the trigger, how to avoid the trigger.
How does living with a terminal disease change your view on life?
The most important thing I've come to understand is mutuality. You know, I have to bring half of what there is in the relationship. The other person brings half of what there is in the relationship.
This week, we are honored to bring you one of the most special episodes of the podcast. Jackie Acho is a MIT-trained scientist, author, management consultant, and empathy coach. But Jackie is also facing the greatest challenge that anyone can meet. 2 years ago, she was diagnosed with a virulent form of ovarian cancer, and she is battling for her life. As we record this, she is still in the middle of chemotherapy treatments. So we are deeply honored that she wanted to come onto the podcast and share her answers to the 9 questions on how to know yourself.
The core of Jackie's philosophy comes from her work as an empathy consultant. Before her cancer, Jackie was using empathy to help organizations like the Cleveland Police figure out better ways of doing business. For Jackie, empathy is the key to constructing successful organizations as well as healthy relationships. It's also central to her battle with cancer. It's her means of fighting off fear and despair. In our conversation, I was blown away by Jackie's incredible bravery, wisdom, and humanity. I learned so much from her. So if you want to hear a really enlightening and inspiring episode, I urge you to listen to this one.
If you want to hear more of Eric's conversation with Jackie, head to 9-questions.com, where we are happy to provide the full versions of all of our podcasts to our Patreon supporters.
Jackie, once again, thank you so much for coming on. And we'll start with question 1, which is, what are you?
So, I mean, this is the question that I asked myself from the time I was really young, right? Like, what am I? What are we doing here, right? So at this point, 53, having seriously faced mortality, right? I was actually told to go into hospice twice already. So I'm supposed to be dead. So everything's gravy from here on out. I feel, and I can say at this point, and I think that all of these experiences add up to a kind of insight that I wouldn't have had without them anyway, that I am an evolving soul in a human body. And sometimes that experience is challenging, right? I mean, a lot of us face different physical challenges and diseases and different things that we don't have much control over. But at the core of it, I'm energy. I'm love wrapped up in skin and bones. I know that I am part of a whole that I don't fully comprehend, but I get glimpses of from time to time when I have more clarity.
Can I ask you about this? Because here you are, an MIT trained scientist, and you're talking about things, some of which have a scientific basis, like energy, but some of which don't, like soul. And so can you tell me a little bit about how you reconcile that insight with your scientific background?
You know, the more I studied science, the more mystical I became, to be honest, because if you look really deeply into the smallest quarks, or if you look out into the universe, it is so much more beautiful and well-organized than anything human beings could do. The thing that gets in the way of our appreciating the beauty and the incredible nature of what's out there is our own arrogance. You know, we think that we somehow have designed everything just because we have scratched the surface of how things are organized. Okay, we barely know bupkis. I mean, we really, you know, and even going through this cancer journey, you know, I really understand how little we know about the human body and how to prevent and heal some of these diseases, and what we've done to the environment to create in some way these challenges that we face in our human bodies. So it's our arrogance that sometimes we pass off as science and evidence-based medicine and all of that kind of stuff. But if we can have a humility in how we approach the science that really is just uncovering the language of God or whatever you want to name that, then I think we put ourselves in the right place.
What does your notion of what you are do for you?
Well, it's a meaningful question as I'm fighting cancer, because what it does for me is it helps me know that I'm more than this struggling human body. I'm more than that. And that there's still meaningful work I can do in the world. There's still meaningful conversations to have. There's still meaningful love to give and receive. And it also helps me to think and know I don't have any proof, and I don't know, and I don't believe hook, line, and sinker into any particular religious dogma, but it helps me to believe that something will carry on if my body doesn't. All of us at some point, our bodies are not going to carry on.
Yeah.
But I think that there's just way more to the world, and it fascinates and energizes me to think about it that way.
All right. Why don't we move on to question two, which is, what is your purpose?
Yeah, I think all of our purposes is to love. And I think that it comes in different forms and flavors. So Madeline Lingle, you know, who wrote A Wrinkle in Time, has a beautiful quote that all true art is channeling cosmos into the chaos. So bringing a little bit of heaven on earth into this worldly experience. And I feel that my art is around writing and speaking, you know, and empathy has been one of the little gems that I've investigated, right? But there's also been, you know, living this cancer experience as a woman who is a trained scientist, who knows a lot about business, knows a lot about how the whole cancer industrial complex works, and being able to speak and write about my experience in that too. So I feel like I have my own little assignments with respect to channeling cosmos into the chaos.
Can we talk a little bit about empathy? Because it's given your work that as that is the, in some ways, a focal point of one of your purposes.
So it probably helps to define empathy the way I think about it anyway, the way I've thought about it since I started studying it. It's the ability to understand the feelings of another and have an appropriate emotional response. So that last part is really important, and it's often left out.
Yeah.
But it's really important because I can feel what you're feeling and take my own emotional trip down memory lane, leaving you in the dust and not actually being there to have an appropriate emotional response with you. Or I can sit with you in whatever it is you're having to sit with. And sometimes just knowing you're not alone, just knowing you have somebody sitting with you in something that's difficult or something that's joyful makes all the difference. And I've definitely found that throughout my experience with cancer. And cancer is a very triggering situation for a lot of people, whether they look at me and say, oh, she lived such a healthy life. If she got cancer, maybe I could. Or you know, my loved one died badly, and so I really can't look at that situation anymore, or, you know, or whatever their response is. I find that it's one of the harder triggers for people to maintain their center and be able to sit with me in whatever it is, whether it's good news or bad news.
Sure. It's so scary.
It's so scary.
Yeah.
Fear. So empathy is actually the antidote to fear, but fear is, you know, makes our empathy go down because we can't go there.
Question three, who are you really?
Yeah. So it's related to the other questions, but I'm going to go back to love, perfectly imperfect, because I'm in a human body. Mm-hmm. And a piece of a whole that I can't pretend to fully understand. But I just know that you and I aren't as separate as we think we are. But one thing that's really important to note is that hands-on parenting is one of the best ways to develop empathy that we have. So you don't have to be a parent to develop empathy, but two times in our lives, our empathic circuits are growing like gangbusters. One is during early childhood development, and then it's a two-way street. So when you become a parent, you're also having that same communication with your child who doesn't necessarily have words yet, and you're trying to understand what it is they need and trying to have this emotional connection with them. So when I went off on my own, started my own business and worked work around my kids and was able to spend more time hands-on parenting my kids, my empathy grew. And then I was able to take all of that back into my work. So I would say that, you know, my work was better with clients. I better understood clients. I was better able to co-create with clients.
So in some ways, you're helping your clients also understand who they are.
You know, whatever speaks to you tells you a little something about, it gets you to reflect on your lived experience and what you enjoyed and what you didn't enjoy and where you can lean into the thing that's going to make you sparkly, you know, that's going to make you, going to light you up. And
I like this as an exercise. I'm now that you just mentioned this, I hadn't really thought of this before, but sitting down, if you want to know who you are, sit down and say, okay, who are all the people you're connected to and what do they need from you? Yeah. And, you know, so I think about myself as, you know, father, son, professor, teacher, husband, you know, friend. Well, those are all, you know, I would say who I am, sure, at some level, all those things, but they're all contingent upon, okay, they're actually living relationships here. Yeah. And what is it that really who I am is, you know, how am I meeting the, you know, the needs of other people in relationship to myself? And I hadn't really thought of that before. That's great.
Yeah, that's empathy. It's that mutuality. So empathy is the gateway to love, you know, which underpins all these relationships. And what you're aiming for is a kind of mutuality that grows with the relationship because things change over time, right? My 18-year-old son needs something very different than my 1-year-old son needed.
Yeah.
And my 20-year-old daughter needs something different than my 3-year-old daughter needed, right? But growing with them in that relationship is... that's the juice.
Yeah. I'm going to do that this afternoon. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to do this. I'm going to write down everybody in my life, you know, and I'm going to say, okay, what is it they need? And I think that's going to be actually a really useful exercise.
And what do you need? What do you need that they provide? Right.
Sure.
Like, I mean, I will tell you right now that going through these treatments for ovarian cancer, and at this point, I mean, it's a pretty brutal chemo every 2 weeks. I just had it last Thursday, right? Like I'm going to have it again 2 weeks from then, right? And I wouldn't be doing this if I weren't jazzed by watching the lives of my children unfold. I think I'd be done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, they just by virtue of being who they are, this is what's so mutual about it. By being who they are, they give me something that is precious that only they can give me.
You have a remarkably brave spirit. I'm just going to acknowledge that right now. So it's remarkable to hear you share this. So thank you.
I mean, what are you going to do?
There's
no choice. There's no choice. As long as I'm here, I've got to live.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but there's ways of doing that. And it just, wow, it's really inspiring to hear how you're,
well, thank you.
You're proceeding. Why don't we move to question four, which is, what are your dreams telling you?
So this is a really interesting question for me right now, because when I go to sleep and I dream, I'm usually a healthy person in my dreams, right? I lived 50 years super healthy. I mean, the doctors were like, go away. There's nothing wrong with you. And then boom, I get a cancer diagnosis and I'm suddenly in a different category. But my identification with myself is as a healthy person with lots to give and lots to live. And so my dreams continually tell me that I'm not done yet. That's what they tell me.
Yeah.
You know, and during the day, you know, if things get, there are times when things get difficult, there were points where things were really painful, right? But my dreams would tell me, wait, you're not done yet. You're not allowed to give up yet.
And is there a dream in particular that signifies that for you? Do you have one like recurring dream that keeps coming back?
No, they're just very normal situations. Like, so a lot of, you know, when you're a person fighting an illness, a lot of the dreams become about normal things like swimming in the ocean again, or, you know, traveling with my husband, like we planned, right? Like having the retirement we planned, rather than going to Istanbul, Turkey for 6 months of chemotherapy, going to, you know, New Zealand for a fun trip. You know, moving my son into college this fall, right? I have, my dreams have become very normal, the kinds of things that most people, well, at least I would have taken for granted.
Question five, which is how, not what, are you feeling?
So I think the answer to that question has two levels, and one is conscious and one is subconscious. And I think that the subconscious part drives a lot more than we realize. And so actually trying to name what you're feeling and how you're feeling at any particular time is really important work, because it then motivates how you are in the world, how you respond to other people. So do you want me to talk about how I'm feeling right now?
Sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm feeling at any given time, including right now, a multitude of things, right? So I'm feeling energized by the conversation with you. I love talking about these kinds of intellectual and spiritual and emotional constructs. So I love this conversation, and that part of me is feels like a very normal part of me. It's been part of who I am for years. You know, but then I also have a part of me that's afraid right now of, you know, what's going to happen to me physically, because I don't have control. They don't have great answers for ovarian cancer, and I don't have control over this, and it doesn't matter. I've worked my butt off to eat the right way and do the right exercises and meditate and everything that hyperbaric oxygen, hyperthermia, mistletoe injection, whatever you can do, I've done. But I've realized that I don't have control over that. So I definitely have fear.
What do you do with the fear state? Because that's a really uncomfortable state to exist in.
Yeah. And you have to do something about it. Otherwise, it gets in the way of the good stuff.
Yeah.
I journal. I get it out. I was doing talk therapy for a while. EMDR, eye movement, eye movement, desensitization, processing over some traumatic things that were continuing to subconsciously sort of trigger bigger fear even into a current situation.
Yeah.
I talked to my husband. I can talk to him pretty openly. I talked to close friends. But, you know, like I was saying to you, not everybody can sit with you in these experiences. So I've learned who gets triggered by my fear and who can handle it. And it's not a large group that can handle it. But mostly I get it out. And once you get it out in words, whether it's written or spoken or something, it has less power than it did when it was rolling around in your head is a big monster.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I sort of talk myself into today right now, I'm not in any pain. I'm here having this conversation with you. As far as I can tell, my brain still works fine. The essence of me is still here. I don't have to live in big fear of the future if I can just get myself down to this day. This is what's actually happening. It's not, you know, I'm not projecting myself into some bad situation that hasn't come to pass yet.
Question six, who's writing your life story?
I mean, I think we are all writing our own life story for better or worse. and I would say that I was more automatically writing my life story with a lot of cultural influence, definitely up until about age 40. And then when I had kids, something clarified for me and it started to become more of an inside out experience. And since that time, and then especially with the cancer diagnosis, I have been more proactively writing my life story, you know, really prioritizing where I put my time and attention and with whom I put my time and attention. And that is quite liberating, actually. Quite liberating. There are things that I don't pretend to have control over, but what I do control is my response to whatever happens during the day, and also my knowledge of my own thoughts and feelings so that I can be more conscious of how I turn that into who I am in the world and what my life story is.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing with the idea of a life story is that, well, there's a central character, which is us. And then the character is an ego. And so I'm curious, since you've gotten your cancer diagnosis, how your story has changed and then how this character, Jackie, has changed.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of us we're like stars in our own hero's tale, right? And you know, there's always this sort of how you move through challenges. I have thought, and I continue to think, that part of my job here, maybe all of our jobs, but definitely part of my job, it feels like, is to go through hard things and to be able to articulate, what needs to change about the system that will make the things not so hard anymore. Mm-hmm. And cancer is one of those things that I have been assigned to go through for some reason.
I don't know if you're familiar, there's a part of the brain called the default mode network. So when we're not engaged with a particular task that's requiring our attention or concentration, our brains reverts back to the default mode network. And the default mode network tends to be very ruminative. It tends to be either in the past or the future, and it tends to be very self oriented. It's what we do when we daydream. It's also interesting. It's what gets activated when we listen to stories. And so I've been trying to use this now, like when I'm finding myself caught up in my own moment and I'm not actually doing something and I'm, you know, getting lost here. Oh, okay. This is my default mode network at play. And what is my default mode network? How is it organized around myself? And so I'm curious, how would you characterize your own default mode network? When you're not distracted by something in particular and you're in those moments when you're just with yourself, how does this, you know, character you, how is it getting fabricated?
Yeah, if I'm honest about it, I think I have to say that my default mode network is, you know, always trying to be resilient right now. Right. So like there's the story of why the hell did this happen to me? That then goes into, well, there must be some thing I can do to make meaning out of it. And it's a struggle between those two questions and those two forces for me, especially around the cancer. You know, before that, I think I had quite a bit of clarity around, you know, what work I was supposed to do and who I was supposed to be. And, you know, I had a very typical identity as a busy working parent, et cetera, et cetera. But with the cancer, there's more of a struggle between you know, how did this happen? Why did this happen? I did my best to take care of myself. I did my best to get through the treatments, but you know, the science really fails for a lot of cancers, including this one. And as a scientist, that's disappointing to me. With, okay, so I'm supposed to make some meaning out of this. I'm supposed to try and advocate for integrative care. I'm supposed to survive this so that I can help other people survive this, perhaps, you know, and I can only do what I can do for myself, but that has some purpose and some meaning still. But it's a struggle.
I would imagine that that would be a big challenge, the whole why me kind of, like,
sure,
feeling
why me and why not me,
yeah,
right? Like, why me? I was so healthy. I did everything to take care of myself. Why not me? I have the background to try and sort these things out in a way that a lot of people couldn't. And it will be helpful. It has been helpful to people. Uh-huh. Why not me? I'm not particularly lucky or unlucky when it comes to the genetic pool. Like, I don't have these cancer genes, so to speak, but 95% of people don't. So
yeah,
why not me? Right. So,
right. Do you own your shit, or does your shit own you?
Yeah, so I would say more and more I own my shit. And, uh-huh, you know, prior to having children, my shit owned me more. And by shit, you know, I think that has to do with all the identities that you carry through this life, most of which are externally assigned, and the expectations that come with those identities. Again, most of which are externally assigned, or, you know, perhaps defined in relationship by the other person, not necessarily by you. And having children was a real centralizing force for me, where I felt like I had some knowing from the inside out about these human beings more than anybody else. I didn't, you know, trust anybody who was telling me, you know, something different from my instincts around my own kids, because we had that time together. We had that empathic connection. And from that point forward, I just started living a little bit differently, a little more inside out, where I was really searching for and finding more mutuality in the relationships. And, you know, in order to have that mutuality, you have to get your shit out of the way, your subconscious fears and all that kind of stuff. You've got to name it. You've got to move through it. You've got to get beyond it. And then you also have to, you know, hope that the other person is doing the same kind of work, or has done some of the same kind of work, because then the relationship can be unfettered.
Yeah,
and it's the shit is what fetters the relationship.
Well, it's funny, when I posed this question to my father-in-law, who's a very proper guy, and he wrote this email back to me. He was like, "I'd like your questions except for, you know, question 7, which is needlessly vulgar and immature. I just should just use possessions." And I was like, "Well, it, you know, it's not really about possessions, but
emotional shit."
Yeah, yeah. But you know, it can be if you want it. You know, these questions are all about just exploration. But the funny thing about this, and this is what I've been thinking about on this, is it's a lot about interpretation. So there's how do you interpret shit? And then also, how do you interpret own? And in a lot of the conversations, it's really, it's how do we cope with the parts of ourselves that are uncomfortable, that we don't want? And, but so much of that is itself interpretive. So I might be a real asshole, but for me, that's perfectly fine. You know, I don't, you know, I go around like, "Oh, I'm getting my way," you know, but not really recognizing all the havoc that's wreaking on everyone else around me, until it's like something comes and confronts me. So I think that's the interesting thing, is how do we gain an interpretive lens into our own processes so that we begin to see this? And I was wondering
I think most of our shit stems from fear. You know, even anger stems from fear. And I think that anything that doesn't result in a generative mutual relationship is shit. So it's a lot. There's a lot individually, societally, and fear sells and fear is profitable. So we get triggered over and over again. So part of owning your shit is realizing when you get triggered and talking yourself down, or learning how to reject the trigger, how to avoid the trigger. And that's hard work because it's constant.
Yeah.
It's constant. We're not set up to support this flow of the currency of empathy that I dream about. We're set up to profit off the currency of fear and chaos.
My therapist, I was describing sometimes when Thea and I get into arguments, and he says, "Oh, those are your intersecting vulnerabilities." And I'm okay, I'm going to work with that. And so the next time Thea and I were having a fight, I'm saying, "This is just our intersecting vulnerabilities, damn it."
Right.
Of worked a little bit.
A little bit. I think it would help.
But it is kind of that way.
Maybe not to say it out loud, but definitely to help.
Well, can we talk a little bit about owning then? How do you go about owning? And I don't even know if owning is the right word, but.
Well, I think owning is a good word. And I think it has to do with being able to acknowledge this underlying emotion that's motivating your behavior. And on the bad side, it's almost always fear. On the good side, it's almost always love. So I think that when you own the fear that's driving bad behavior, you can interrupt whatever bad behavior is getting in the way of these mutual relationships you'd like to, you know, ultimately develop. And I think that on the plus side, when you own the love, you can be really joyful and present in a moment.
Uh-huh.
I think it's owning all the good and bad stuff.
Yeah. We've talked a little bit about some of this. I'm just wondering if there was anything more in terms of kind of going back to the fear and when the shit is compressing us. In all of your work, have you learned anything else that you do to either recognize that or to cope with that or to step out of it? Because I think it's the hard thing about fear. It can be such a tight grip on us, it can come out in so many indirect ways.
Yeah. Empathy is the antidote to fear. So usually I get over my fear by sharing it in some way with somebody who can sit with it for a minute and help mm-hmm. me dissipate it. The other thing that is helpful to me that I do just on my own is realize this is going to pass. Like it has passed before and it will pass again. And this feeling is not forever. It's transient.
Question 8, how do you find love?
I open myself up to it, but with discernment. Because there are a lot of relationships that are not mutual because people are wounded in so many ways and their fears and their triggers can get in the way of the relationships. The most important thing I've come to understand really pretty recently in life is mutuality, that I have to bring half of what there is in the relationship, the other person brings half of what there is in the relationship. And whether we're talking about, you know, something that's happening in their life, something that's happening in my life, or appreciating something together, whether it be a sunset or music or food or whatever, that it's this, this feeling of mutuality, that you don't feel like you're being sapped in any way. Mm-hmm. And you also don't feel like you're being overwhelmed in any way. And I think that the mutuality is the most important thing about love that I maybe didn't realize until later in life.
Well, I'm wondering, it's as you're speaking, I talk to my students about this with respect to intimacy. And I describe to them what I think of as intimacy, which is it starts with mutuality, then there's vulnerability, and then there's affirmation. And there's this sort of cycle of mutuality, vulnerability, and affirmation.
I like
that. And part about then loving, we can do that in our intense interpersonal relationships, but just with respect to the world, and we can see our mutuality with all other people. We can see our mutuality with all other life forms at some level. Right. Now, right. but there has to be, we can't be vulnerable. We can't go and be vulnerable to the lion. It's going to eat right. us.
Right.
So we have to, you know, we can't be all woo woo about it. We've got to, you know, be careful to some extent. But I think a lot of it is what so many people desperately want is intimacy and that feeling of connectedness. And it's the question of both how do we open ourselves up once we find mutuality? And then also, how do we negotiate with people who might not necessarily be able to reciprocate with vulnerability or affirmation to us because of whatever other issues?
I don't think we do those negotiations.
You don't think
we do
those?
I'm done with those negotiations.
Yeah.
Anybody who can't be mutual with me, I really am fighting for my life. I cannot allocate energy there anymore.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of that, you know, a lot of really overextending myself, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm done with that. I'm done. But so I think the mutuality is a prerequisite for the vulnerability. You can't be vulnerable to just everybody and anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that said, I think you can present yourself honestly in the world, right? So like whoever's listening to this podcast, you know, will probably find this conversation to touch on vulnerable topics, right? So I don't mind being vulnerable in this way. But when it comes to interpersonal relationships, there's got to be a pretty even give and take. You know, I think biology gives us this model, right? Where, you know, two different pieces come together and to create a new whole, right, in a human being. And it's a real 50-50 deal.
Yeah.
And I think that part of what we've gotten wrong is that we somehow feel like we're winning if we give less but get more. But it's really isn't, it doesn't create this current of love that we crave as sentient beings. We all crave it. And there's a certain current, or you could even call that a currency of empathy, right?
Yeah.
That is our lifeblood. We're built for it.
Okay. Question 9, where are you going from here?
So I'm an ever evolving soul, and I don't pretend to control or know where all of this is going to end up. I have my hopes and my dreams and my prayers about, you know, a stage of life where I am free of disease and, you know, get to that point where I get to appreciate all the little things without the fear of what might happen. But the truth is, you know, there's always fear about remission when you've had cancer. It doesn't really matter what cancer you've had. It's something that you have to metabolize on a regular basis. But my soul will continue to evolve. You know, I still feel that there's work that I'm supposed to do in the world. Like doing your podcast, I've got another book actually that's been drafted called More Empathetic Cancer Care. I think those are things that should be out in the world. And for some reason I was supposed to go through these experiences and channel that. You know, I continue to give talks. I just gave a commencement address for John Carroll University where, you know, all the context of all of these experiences, shitty and great, you know, get channeled into thoughts and ideas that might inspire people. So I feel like there's still stuff I'm supposed to, still cosmos I'm supposed to channel into this chaos. Not all of it has to do with cancer, but some of it does. But when it comes right down to sort of the core of it all, I want to stick around for the fun part with my husband and my kids.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it feels to me like that's how my soul will evolve. But I don't have control over all of that. So I will have to live the fun part, whether I, you know, get some sort of clear remission or not.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing just your incredible bravery and resilience, and your soul. This has just been a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate your generosity.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I mean, these are the conversations that matter. And, you know, to have a place for all of these thoughts to land now is really life-giving to me. So I've appreciated the opportunity to talk to you, and I appreciate your work. Oh, thanks. I wish I could be your graduate student.
Oh, me too.
Maybe someday.
Yeah.